we already have a list of 44 possible decisions we can take that are scary, that are big in our world, and that we are now really looking at and hope to show you over the next couple of years that we are willing to take decisions that are not easy and maybe also a little bit hard on the business, but very, very good for the planet.
Welcome to Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. I'm your host, Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simply Flying. Every Thursday, I have important conversations with top aviation executives, technology entrepreneurs, and policymakers helping aviation take climate action. Conversations that help separate the signal from the noise. Whether you are a frequent flyer or an airline executive, if you care about sustainability or simply love traveling, welcome aboard. My guest today is Sita Skelikens, who is the SVP of Sustainability and Strategy at KLM Royal Dutch Airlines. Sita has had a fantastic career, not just in aviation, which she has joined recently, but with the government, with Heineken. She's worked in countries like Myanmar, and she brings all of this experience to KLM to build an airline that is doing good for the planet and doing good for business. A tough one to crack, but Sita is open to all questions, and I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I enjoyed doing it. Sita, welcome to the show. You just told me you took a train from Paris. You did not fly on KLM despite coming from an international city. Why did you take the train and not fly from Paris to Amsterdam?
Well, I also enjoy taking the train. I mean, it's a very good alternative to flying. It's good for the environment, and it allows me to really also work and get some stuff done. So for me, it's a fantastic way to get to Paris or any other city that's reachable within about 3.5-4 hours, I think makes lots of sense and is also part of the future.
Now, you may have just offended a lot of road warriors here who love to work in flight, who love to work in airplane lounges, who love to work at the airport. Do you feel that there's a big shift coming where for shorter distances, people are switching to other modes of transport?
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I love working in airport lounges as well. I love being on a plane too. But I think for a lot of destinations, be it London, Paris, well, Brussels, obviously, the train is a perfect alternative. So I think it makes lots of sense, you know, and we try to improve those services so that they can really also compete with the services we have on board, because, of course, those are magnificent. I mean, planes have really, really good services, and trains are starting to catch up now. So I think it's exciting and there's a lot of promise there. And actually, as a company, we're also trying to improve the train services by working together and offering flights and train services together, because we believe there's a really big part of the future of traveling that is in that combination.
How exactly are you doing that? Does KLM have a code share service with trains to certain parts of Europe? We all know your current CEO was the former CEO of the trains in Netherlands, the trains company in Netherlands. What is KLM doing for to encourage this intermodality?
And of course, indeed, it helps that our CEO used to be responsible for trains in the Netherlands because she knows the industry really well. But one example is that we're trying to change the flights to Brussels into more more trains to Brussels. So we've bought up a lot of seats so that we can actually offer that service also, that our passengers can take the train to Brussels or the train from Brussels to Amsterdam to then go on another flight. And we are in many different corporations and alliances where we work together with the national rail company, but also rail companies from other neighboring countries. We work together with Schiphol on that. So we're trying to figure out what are the biggest bottlenecks for people, not reasons not to take the train. They can be in availability of seats. They can be in ease of travel. They can be in, you know, the perceived difficulty of going from train to plane. So how can we take those barriers away by working together and improving the offer and making it easier for people to make those choices? So we have a big working group. I'm on the steer committee as well of that. And it's not an easy job, I can tell you, but it is something we're really working together on with partners, and we're trying to really, really improve so that whatever we offer is a good alternative for flying, or at least part of the flying trip.
That's fascinating. You mentioned something that I just want to dig in. You buy seats on trains. So you pre-buy, let's say, to Brussels or to Paris. What happens if these seats are not sold? And as a KLM passenger, do I get a KLM section, which is blue in color or something?
That's a good question. Probably they're not used, as far as I know. But I would have to get back to that. But as far as I know, I mean, many of them are used. And if they're not, that's a risk we are willing to take.
Right. Okay. Now, we of course started with trains and intermodality, but you are the head of sustainability of an airline. How do you balance, you know, sending people to trains versus running an airline and filling up the plane more sustainably? How do you balance the two objectives there?
Well, I think I have the best job within KLM because I'm responsible for strategy for the whole company. I'm responsible for transformation, for innovation, and for sustainability. And why do I say that or emphasize on that? That's because it's a big puzzle that requires all of those elements to really make it work. So I'm not just responsible for sustainability strategy. I'm responsible for transforming the company into a more successful, more sustainable company towards the future. And that means we have to transform. We have to look at our business model. That means we have to look at innovation to grasp every potential there is to improve our business model, to improve the ways of flying, with the end game or the end goal to become, eventually net zero in 2050. Hopefully that's a goal we're all striving towards, but also really, really improve the way we do business so that we become more sustainable, but remain financially successful as well.
Now, that's a tough nut to crack. To remain financially successful, most airlines prioritize growth into new areas or increasing frequency. But traditionally, growth has led to larger overall carbon emissions. How do you balance now? The second balance is, how do you balance growth with sustainability?
Well, it starts with a belief, I think. And the belief I have and many share with me is that there can be growth or success if you operate more sustainably. On the one hand, that is because if you become more sustainable, for instance, you use less fuel, you decrease your costs. And on the other side, you can also offer a better offering, a more sustainable offering, and thereby also create a new market, potentially. So I think there's lots of opportunities to do things better, to increase our creativity in ways of doing business, introduce solutions. So it requires having an open mind, thinking out of the box. And once you start implementing that way of thinking, there's lots of low-hanging fruit, lots of difficult business decisions. But at the end of the day, I think there is a lot of potential in. It's a bit of an old paradigm that the only way to grow is to grow unsustainably. I don't think that's true. I think that's changing. I believe businesses can do good. And I'm here to prove that in the next couple of years that we can really do both, that it doesn't have to be a trade-off necessarily. I think there's a lot of potential to do really both and prove to the world that we can. It's not going to be easy. It's going to take a lot of time, but I don't believe it's impossible.
I'm glad to hear the optimism. What are some of the big key pillars for KLM to get to net zero by 2050 in your sustainability strategy?
Yeah, so we look at that timeline from two different angles. One is a sort of intermediate timeline, so that's 2030. And up until 2030, we've set the goal in line with SBTi. Say we want to have a relative target of 30% less CO2 emissions and 12% absolute less CO2 footprint. And that means that we have to take a lot of small steps, a lot of actions to get to that ambitious target. That's by fleet renewal, that is by operational efficiencies and operational improvements, and by purchasing sustainable aviation fuel. So we're really looking at our entire business. We're now also kickstarting a project called Reduce Now, where we talk to every business division and we ask them, what can you do to help us reach those goals? And you have to think of everything that can be top of mind. It can be about catering on board. It can be about flight operations and flight plans and routing. It can be about whatever the staff wears. It can be really small things and really big things. And we're trying to sort of classify them now, see their potential impact, and then translate them into sort of KPIs and action plans. The fleet renewal, well, is mostly already set. Most of the agreements have already been set, but a new plane makes a big, big difference. It can be up to 40 or 50% less CO2 output or footprint. So that's a fantastic way also to get to that goal. And then we're also going to buy, and we have already committed to quite a lot of that, at least 10% sustainable or more sustainable aviation fuel. So that's until 2030. And that also has to do, the reason why we sort of look at those two timelines is because we believe that innovation in the future, after 2030 or just slightly before, will provide real breakthrough solutions in the areas of electric flying or hydrogen or hybrid or whichever shape or form. But we believe that a lot of the manufacturers, a lot of the bright minds at different universities are working on really big breakthrough solutions that we, let's be frank, desperately need in order to get to that net zero in 2050. We can't get there with just operational efficiencies, and we don't think just buying sustainable aviation fuel is going to be enough either. We really need to work on those breakthrough innovations. And that's our agenda until, well, we're already working on that agenda, but we realize that most of those solutions will come to market end of this decade, beginning of the next decade and beyond.
Okay, let's focus on sustainable aviation fuel then, because it's short term, 2030. I was with your team just last week in Amsterdam, and I heard a very interesting figure that 0.8% was the big figure, where in 2022, 0.8% of all fuel was SAF, all fuel flown by KLM was SAF. It might sound like a paltry number, but we know this is huge because other airlines like United carried 0.1% on their complete flights. And of course, we are scaling up. How significant is this? Of course, you sit in the Netherlands where there is decent SAF availability, as opposed to other parts of the world like Australia, where there is none. There is zero SAF. How do you work the supply and demand and the price of SAF and incorporate that into your 2030 goals?
So indeed, this year we are adding 1% SAF, sustainable aviation fuel, to all of our flights, which I agree with you. It sounds like it's not a lot at all. And yet it's also a big step of making that, I'd say, making it into a mainstream decision or making it into a standard, really, is what we've done. And it's definitely a starting point. And like I said, towards 2030, we will increase it to at least 10%. And beyond, we will have to step up because of legislation coming our way, because of the mandate from the European Union. But it's something we applaud and embrace because we believe that we have a role in accelerating the market for sustainable aviation fuel. And how do we do that? Accelerate that market is by looking at investment, like we've done in Delfzijl with the Sky Energy factory that's being built and hopefully will be operational in the next couple of years. We have big deals with parties like Neste or DG Fuels. And we look to support other type of parties that are working on sustainable aviation fuel through letters of intent or letters of support so that we help them get access to the investments they need. Quite often, these parties, startups or bigger players need to be able to show that there's going to be some type of demand going forward in order for them to get the investments to be able to build their factories and become operational. Those are, I would say, that the most important ways in which we help support the market. We realize that at this point in time, it's quite unaffordable. It's expensive. that has to do with the fact that there is not as much supply as we would like there to be. We hope that by accelerating market demand, by working together with other players, with other, well, even competitors and other parties in the value chain, we can further push the market forward, increase the supply, and hopefully once there's more supply, the price will also come down a little bit, so that will allow us to buy even more sustainable aviation fuel.
That does make sense. Let's look at the ramp up, right? You need to ramp up significantly. It's 1% this year in 2023. You want this to be 10 times this amount by 2030. That's a huge growth. And it's not, the fact is not lost that SAF currently is anywhere from 3 times to 8 times the price of jet fuel, depending on where you're fueling it. Who pays for this, Sita? Does the passenger pay? Does KLM pay? Do you get subsidies from government? How does this work?
All of the above. So there is a subsidy scheme in the Netherlands, at least until 2025, in which it is incentivized. You see in the United States that there is huge incentives, but mostly in the subsidies for building factories. That has brought the price down quite significantly. The reality is that all of us will have to pay a price to well, bring SAF into our planes and to ramp up the amount of SAF that's there. And maybe one other factor that I didn't mention before is that SAF is not SAF is not SAF. There's a lot of different types of sustainable aviation fuel. And we've also said that we want to go and purchase the sustainable aviation fuel of the highest criteria. So we don't want sustainable aviation fuel to be in competition with food and the food market. We want to source the most sustainable, friendly, the most, the highest criteria, which could potentially be food waste in the future, which now is mostly used cooking oils and animal fats. So there's different things going on at the same time. You have the issue of supply, you have the issue of demand, you have the issue of criteria. And indeed, again, that's also a big puzzle, but it is one in which we are committed to play our part, and we hope to work together with governments, with our clients, with our customers, with companies that fly our planes, or at least their staff uses our planes, with consumers themselves, and that requires that we all talk a little bit more about what it is, what the effect can be, up to 75% less CO2 footprint, well, depending on the type of SAF, but the best SAF can provide that improvement. So that's an important story to tell, but we have a tendency of sometimes making it a little bit complicated, and we have a role to play there so that we take along all of those parties, all of those players, all of those stakeholders, so that together we can make this a reality.
It's interesting that you mentioned communicating about these efforts and that the airlines tend to make this a bit complicated. I think KLM sometimes gets rubbed on its knuckles for making it too simplistic, not too complicated. You, of course, you know, I think being in Netherlands or in the part of Europe you're in, there are lots of people who are climate aware. There are lots of climate activists. And every time it seems that you talk about sustainability, someone's out there to come after you. How do you deal with that?
Well, so for the record, I'm in this job for 3 months now. I will have to be a little bit careful here also to respect all the work that has been done in the past. But I think you're referring to a court case that was brought forward by Fossil Free that had issues with our Fly Responsibly campaign in the past. And the reality is that there were 19 types of claims sort of around Fly Responsibly in the use of that. And we already stopped doing that because we understand that the way in which consumers look at greenwashing, the way consumers look at what you can and cannot claim, it's changing rapidly. And that's good. I mean, they are critical and they should be. And I think that's a good thing. And we adapt our communication accordingly to what we see, what we believe. And I think there's a big distinction between what we want to achieve, our dream, and our dream or our purpose is to become a sustainable, become a pioneer in sustainable aviation, to be a front runner in sustainable aviation, to be net zero in 2050. That's our dream. That's our purpose. It's my promise to my team, to the people I talk to, that is at least my promise is that I will work really, really hard in achieving that. But I can't claim it. We cannot claim that we are net zero because we're very, very far away from that. It's a super difficult to abate sector. Everyone recognizes that. So what we have to do is find the right balance between being outspoken about our ambition, being honest about the difficulties and the dilemmas that are on the road ahead on that journey, but also being engaging in a way so that consumers and customers and passengers, well, it's all of the same in a way, that they want to help us achieve that journey. And sure, that's a fine balance, but that's okay. I think it's good to have activists and newspapers and media be critical of us because it keeps us sharp. And at the same time, I hope that there's also room for positivity in a way that what we want to achieve is something exciting. In a way, it's not going to be easy. I stress again, it's going to be really, really difficult, and we're definitely not there yet. But it is something that motivates me and my team every day to try and achieve.
Building on this, you mentioned you're, you know, new in this role at KLM, and this campaign was obviously done before this. But having researched well for this interview, I know you spent 8 years at Heineken, and part of it was dealing with corporate affairs. And I remember Heineken's Drink Responsibly campaign quite well, which did not attract this kind of a reaction from the world. In fact, it was quite well loved. Drink responsibly, so let's fly responsibly. You know, it makes complete sense. Why is aviation being singled out? What do you have from your time at Heineken that you think you might be able to apply here?
Well, sorry to disagree with you a little bit here. It was enjoy responsibly, and it was more of a sticker, so to say. So it was an industry effort. And it was an outing we were forced to use on all of our commercial outings. But it was not something we necessarily always, well, it depended on the issue and it depended on the format. You would see them on stations for soccer, for instance. But it's a fair question. I think one of the things that happened during my time at Heineken is that we introduced Heineken 0.0. And I think that was a nice solution to have, to be able to at least propose an alternative. And we just spoke about trains. They are an alternative, but they're not as similar an alternative because they can only be short distance, not far distance. And with Heineken 0.0, there was an alternative for a regular beer, so to say. But I mean, coming back to the Enjoy Responsibly wasn't a key campaign necessarily. So I'm not sure if I fully follow the comparison. And it's a different industry as a whole, of course. It brings about different challenges for society, as us flying does. But I think what they two have in common, and this is also why I wanted to work for a B2C company with such a strong brand, is that using the brand in order to bring forward a message and use the brand to also pilot and pivot sustainability solutions, bringing those two together, so to say, is something that excites me. I think consumers appreciate it. When you're a B2C company, that means people will always be extra critical of you because they know of you. And if they love your brand, that also means they're critical of your brand. And I like all of that. I like the dynamics that it brings about, but also the opportunities to really work together with consumers in order to bring such a sustainability ambition to life and engage them on that mission.
So we spoke a lot about strategy. We spoke about, you know, activism and how do you put messages out. But one of the things we haven't spoken about is some of the efforts that are being done today by KLM around sustainability. And actually, I want to bring up the Sustainable Flight Challenge, which is being organized by SkyTeam. I believe you recently participated in a flight or multiple flights for the Sustainable Flight Challenge. It's in the second year running. How did that go for you? What were some of the initiatives you ran through in that? And I think you were on board the flight as well yourself.
I was, yeah. I joined the flight to LA. Well, I was incredibly impressed. So maybe first a little bit of background. In the past, there was a sort of a internal movement called the Bold Moves movement. So there was a group of KLM people who thought of different bold moves and different sort of activities the company could undertake to become much more sustainable. And one of the ideas was this Sustainable Flight Challenge. So it was sort of created within the company, but also quickly realized that only KLM doing such a thing would not have the effect that it would have if it was a SkyTeam initiative, because then so many more airlines would chip in with ideas, with resources and so forth. So it is absolutely something that a lot of people within KLM already love and embrace. And I'm going to talk about what we did on the flight, but I also want to address the fact that within the company, it has spurred so much enthusiasm, so much excitement, and a movement of itself. So to exemplify that, 130 ideas were presented of things that we could improve during the flight, we could do. I spoke to hundreds of employees that were one way or another involved with the Sustainable Flight Challenge. The crew on board was comprised of volunteers entirely. So a lot of people who wanted to be on the flight per se because they were so excited with what we were doing. So I love it. I think it's a fantastic way to get a lot of internal excitement for sustainability, for piloting sustainable solutions, ensuring that we get the right people on board, but also the right ideas, because there's so much knowledge within this company. We have more than 30,000 colleagues, and this has been a fantastic way to engage with many, many of them. And then at the same time, I mean, as you know, change is not easy. Change is hard. And having a couple of flights, it was one return flight to LA and one return flight to Trondheim, but having that set time frame to test ideas that were maybe already longer cooking, to test them and to pilot them is also a fantastic way to lower the barrier a little bit. I mean, we never compromise on safety. I want to be very clear on that. For these nice ideas to pilot, sometimes they can end up in a drawer maybe, you know, so there's a great idea, but when are we going to do it? How are we going to do it? Having that time pressure, having that time frame to test and pilot these different initiatives provides with a great way to get more stuff done. Okay, and then what did we do? We did a heap of things. And again, we engaged all the different business divisions in doing that. So, for instance, cargo looked at different materials to sort of carry the stuff into the belly. They also contributed 1% to a foundation of 1% of their profit. On the flight itself, there was no meat. So it was a vegetarian kitchen, both in business class and economy class. So that sort of spurred a lot of creativity with providing delicious meals, but without the meat that was regularly there, which is also a great way to test how passengers respond, because it is one of those things where we are not 100% sure how our consumers or how our passengers will respond to something like that. So let's test it during one or two flights. We offered sustainable aviation fuel on board, which was even sold by our CEO, Marianne Rintel, who also worked alongside the stewardesses and the stewards, the cabin attendants. Last year, we purchased 39% SAF. This year, we increased that to 100%, even though that goes sort of in a mass balance because you're only allowed to go to 50% in the plane, but we sort of purchased it for that flight to make that bigger investment also. We also looked at a more social side of things, so provided the whole crew with sneakers instead of the heels they normally wear. We also asked or tried to work with our passengers saying maybe you can pack more light, because packing lightly will also reduce weight. And that weight weight is everything, right? The less weight, the less fuel. So that was an important thing. And then we did a lot in the cockpit as well. So we had a different traveling scheme than we would normally have. So we tried to sort of pilot how to save fuel, how to fly more efficient. And that made a big difference as well. We're still waiting for the final results, but those were a lot of the different activities where we tried to really ensure that we did a lot of small things to add up to a big, big result.
Thank you for the detailed answer. I'm wondering, how the reaction of the passengers was when they realized there was no meat on the flight.
Well, that's I can tell you that because actually it was both in the flight as well as in our lounges, so the KLM airport lounge in Amsterdam. And it wasn't as bad as we had worried about. There were some complaints, sure. But not more than usual, I would always say, and that's a good thing. So it wasn't as bad as we had suspected. And that's good. So, I mean, by testing, you know, right? Like on a website with a new app, you can test, do A-B testing, etc. This was a way of doing A-B testing, but then in reality, and it gives you a lot of information. And the right information to make the right decisions.
It seems like there are lots of efforts being taken. Small efforts, big efforts, small efforts like the Sustainable Flight Challenge participation, big efforts like SAF purchases that KLM is doing. But at the same time, we see, especially in the EU, a lot of mandates coming from the government. So, for example, France has just banned short-haul flights. Do you think governments have a role to play, or should the sustainability charge be led by airlines?
Absolutely. Well, you've done some research into me. I also spent many years in politics and working for the Ministry of Economic Affairs, also as the political advisor to the Minister for Trade and Consumer Affairs. And the reason I did that, because I believe that governments and ministers and parliament politics can make a huge difference in setting the right framework to change the way in which we do business providing the right framework for change. So I do believe that governments can play a really big role. I think when you look at what's needed and what's in front of us in terms of the challenge, it's huge. So it means that on the one hand, if governments set a standard, like a mandate, like the EU mandate for SAF, it will help spur the market demand. So, I mean, that will help set up the market further. But governments can also support the innovation framework, the information, the innovation ecosystem that's also really, really needed. I mean, we have one of the best universities in the Netherlands, TU Delft. They're rated, their aerospace engineering is rated even better than MIT. So that means that they're really, really good at what they do. And we need to also emphasize on that and support that. And the government is doing that, by the way. The Dutch government is doing that. I'm sure the French government is doing that in its own right. And many other governments are doing that too. So I think it's about being strict in some instances and also providing the right tools for the ecosystem to really take off at the same time. So I believe there's a big role. And we also want to work together with the government in accelerating that transformation towards sustainable aviation.
We've spoken a lot about things being done today, government's roles. You mentioned TU Delft. Let's talk about that. I remember they had in the past developed a blended wing concept plane. They're working on hydrogen concepts. Let's talk long term now. 2030 to 2050, what are some of the big technologies KLM is betting on to make aviation sustainable?
We're betting on all the innovations that are out there because we will be needing all of them. And it's too soon to say which one will really succeed. Will it be electric flying? Will it be hydrogen? Will it be hydrogen? Will it be a hybrid form? Probably all of the above. And we believe that we have a role in the value chain of those innovations to support different parties that are trying to find the breakthrough solutions. So, for instance, we've just announced a partnership with AeroDelft, which is a fantastic startup with 50 students at the time or at a year's time working on building hydrogen planes. And these students sort of follow each other up and they're quite far already. And it's exciting to see what they can do and how they, with fresh eyes and out of the box thinking, think of other solutions than we might think of. With electric flying, I mean, there's a lot of potential there too. We know that there's going to be probably maybe at least 20-seaters, 30-seaters before the end of this decade. We have announced that we want to have a zero-emission flight, so to say, in 2026. Probably the first flight will be electric. We're working together with an e-flight school that has pipistrels, so very small electric aircrafts. We're using them also in our own pilot schooling. So we're trying to sort of support and work with all of these different parties because it's too soon to say yes or no to a certain technology. There will have to be loads of investments, and before a breakthrough takes place, it's very difficult to say this will happen or that will happen, but we need to sort of ensure that all efforts go into accelerating that journey so that whatever breakthrough there can be, will be, and it will be quick, because we don't have the luxury of time here. So the quicker, the better.
Indeed. Thank you for sharing about this AeroDelft partnership here. It's definitely very encouraging here. Now, when you look at aviation's journey to net zero, beyond KLM, you've worked in multiple industries, multiple countries. What gives you the most hope, Zita?
Wow, that's what gives me the most hope. Well, I'm a hopeful person by nature, so and I always say I'm a sort of realistic optimist, but I'm not sure how realistic I am, because I want to be more optimistic than just realistic, because if I'm only realistic, I could maybe be a little bit pessimistic, so to say, because there are so many question marks. And it's a little bit like with question marks, it's like with whether a glass is half full or half empty. You can say there are so many question marks, so it probably won't work. Or you can say there are so many question marks, so there must be so many opportunities, and let's use all that we have available in terms of resources, bright minds, and so forth to get it done. So it's a bit of what gives me hope. Well, I spend a day this week, actually, Tuesday, I spend an entire day at the TU Delft. And we met with the people working on that special wing modeled after a bird. And that's exciting. You know, it's exciting to see that could, for instance, save 20% of CO2 reduction when it comes to market. And Airbus is already investing in it. So they're working together with them. We looked at the Flying V, which is a V-shaped airplane, which is not reality tomorrow, let's be frank, but it could be reality in a couple of, let's say, 2 or 3 decades, maybe. And there's all these bright minds, all these excited people working on testing it, scaling it up. That excites me. And also to see, I spent the last 2 days in Paris with the top leadership of Air France KLM, and it was very clear that we share a common ambition and vision to be really a front runner in sustainability. And the fact that we have those conversations with senior management, the top 50 of the entire company, and not just me and my sustainability team or a couple of people who feel passionate about it, but the fact that that passion and that ambition is now shared by the top, that gives me lots of hope.
Yes, I fully agree with that. Across the industry, I'm seeing these conversations take place at the highest level. And, you know, where there's a will, there's definitely a way. We have done this as an industry in many other areas. So why not in sustainability as well? Now, focusing on yourself, Zita, you've had a very interesting career. You've worked with governments, you've worked in countries like Myanmar, you've worked with with Heineken, as we spoke with earlier, and here you are as SVP of Sustainability and Strategy at KLM. This role obviously did not exist 10 years ago. How did you get here into this role around sustainability, and what does success look like to you in your role?
It didn't even exist 4 months ago, the role. It's a new role, to the extent that, of course, sustainability was there and strategy was there, but it's now into one role. And also Marianne, the CEO, decided to make it into an executive committee role. So I think that makes it super, super exciting. Why did I want to take the job, or why was I so excited to apply for the job? Is because I believe the timing is right. It was clear also in all of the conversations I had that it was both an intrinsic will and an intrinsic need from the people I spoke with who really wanted to transform sustainably, so who wanted to really step up their engagement. The company wanted that as a whole, but also with lots of outside pressure, with governments, with consumers being critical, as you mentioned yourself. So there was loads of pressure and ambition. Also internally, people wanting to make that difference. And I think timing is very important in these things. If it helps the fact that there are so many people within this company who want to see me, my team, this mission, this journey. They want to see this succeed. You know, everyone wants me to succeed in that sense, because we really do want to transform the company sustainably. And that excites me. I think that makes it into a really, really difficult challenge, because it is a very difficult challenge. It's not something, and that's also what I noticed in my first couple of months in the job, there's not a lot of low-hanging fruit, unfortunately, of things I can pick up and do and, you know, have immediate results, because the company has already been a front runner in the last couple of years, decades even, and the company is already doing a lot. Having said that, we also still need to step up our engagement even further. There's lots of difficult decisions ahead of us where we need to find the, like I said, strike the right balance between our business and sustainability, but also do more in order to achieve the goals that we have already set. So when am I successful? And when are we successful as a company? I think when we have really integrated sustainability into the entire way of doing business, like we've done with safety. Safety is non-negotiable, right? It's not anything you compromise on. And I hope that sustainability will be a value very much like safety. The fact, also when all the different business divisions will feel responsible for the delivery upon that mission. So every business division needs to have their own KPIs, needs to have their own action plan and needs to deliver on that. And we really move forward on those big files, on those big topics, on SAF, making that 10%, minimum of 10% at least a reality, accelerating that market, ensuring that the fleet renewal really also translates into a big, big difference in CO2 reduction, and finding lots and lots of operational improvements in order to bring that figure down further. And we already have a list of 44 possible decisions we can take that are scary, that are big in our world, and that we are now really looking at and hope to show you over the next couple of years that we are willing to take decisions that are not easy and maybe also a little bit hard on the business, but very, very good for the planet. So we will move towards that. And lastly, I want to work together even more with those bright minds of the TU Delft, with the passionate people of the government, with our competitors, with the value chain, in order to bring the ecosystem in line with the big mission that we have towards zero emission. We will need to work together with the industry as a whole. We will need to be super ambitious, and we will need to find solutions in which we really challenge each other, but moreover work together to bring that forward. Because there's things we can control ourselves directly. We will work on that. That's our own agenda. There's very few things we cannot control at all. Think of the weather. But there are a lot of things we can change if we work together. So that's another thing where I would like to be more specific and work together and be transparent about that too, so that people can watch us move in that journey and help us, criticize us, help us, think with us. That's all very, very welcome, because, again, we need everyone on this journey.
Well, I was going to wrap up, but now I'm intrigued again. 44 decisions that can potentially be bad for business but good for the planet. Can you give me an example of one or two of what these might look like?
I can give you an example of one thing we've done in the very recent past, and that is that in the past, we would sometimes bring extra fuel if we would fly to a destination with very expensive fuel. It's called economic tankering. And we've decided to stop doing that, because if you bring additional fuel to a destination, that is a negative weight and it's not sustainable. So even though for the bottom line of the company, it was best to continue to do that, we decided from a sustainability perspective to stop doing that.
Good on you. I'm glad you did it. I'm looking forward to seeing what these other 43 decisions are. Truly appreciate the insights and the openness to all the questions, Sita. The final part of this interview is what I call the rapid fire round, in which we get to know you a bit more personally. And I'm going to ask you a question. You have to give me a one-word reply or a short phrase reply.
Okay.
And I'll start with something simple. What's your favorite movie?
Dirty Dancing.
Okay, that was easy. And favorite book?
Favorite book? What's my favorite book? I was incredibly impressed by Het Hoge Nest, but I'm not sure what it's in English. I think The Sisters from Auschwitz or something, from Roxane van Ypres, which is about two sisters who were incredibly brave during the Second World War. And I find it, on the one hand, really, really petrifying to, again, realize what happened during those days, but also incredibly motivating and inspiring to see how two sisters were so incredibly brave to really help others during the war. So it's a big recommendation.
All right, what's your favorite city?
What's my favorite city? Amsterdam.
That's an easy win. You live there. So
well, I like Amsterdam. I love New York.
We'll stick to Amsterdam.
Okay.
Easy for us, right? What is something you want to learn?
Oh dear. What do I want to learn? French.
Okay. I guess taking the trains to Paris often enough will help.
Yeah.
Who do you look up to, Sita?
Many people. I look up to Hillary Clinton. I think she really paved the way for many, many women. And she had such a hard time doing that. So much criticism. So I think, I have a lot of female role models who have literally paved the way, because I think so many of them are so brave and have to do the work under tough circumstances and more criticism. So I think once you remain standing in that environment, I think that's something to be saluted and applauded.
Fantastic. And finally, what is the best advice you have received?
The best advice I ever received. I received so much good advice. It's not easy to. Probably it's a bit of a, I don't know if it's original enough, but it's about the difference between being right and having others agree with you. That in the Dutch you say gelijk krijgen en gelijk hebben, which is difficult to translate. But I think sometimes we can focus. Well, we feel that we are right. In whatever we feel or whatever our opinion is, and we become really frustrated if others don't agree with us. And I think it's about working to create mutual understanding and from there try to persuade potentially others instead of just forcing your opinion through. Because that's what maybe something I did a lot in the start of my career. I was more forceful, and now I try to be a little bit more diplomatic. Because I think what counts is the end game, not whether you are right and you can claim that you're right, but the fact that the outcome is maybe that you move in the same direction.
That is very fascinating, because the closest translation I've heard of that is be kind, not right.
Yeah.
So anytime you feel like forcing your way through with your own opinion and you think you're right, try to be kind, and that already encompasses listening to others and having, being open to other ideas. So be kind and not right.
I can use that. That's a very good advice.
Simple enough. Four words. Be kind, not right.
Yeah.
Zita, it has been a pleasure speaking with you. I do wish you all the best in your sustainability journey going forward. And I'm really excited to see what KLM has up its sleeves for the next 43 initiatives, which will help be good for the planet. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sustainability in the Air. Aviation is one of the hardest to decarbonize industries, yet there are multiple paths to get to net zero. Awareness is key to a green future. So please give us your support to help our sustainable aviation insights reach a wider audience. You can do this by sharing this episode on your network, on LinkedIn, Twitter, or even WhatsApp. Or perhaps you might consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this episode. You can start a conversation with us by writing to us at podcast@simplifying.com. And for more content on sustainable aviation, please visit our website, green.simplifying.com, and join the movement. Sustainability in the Air is an original podcast by Simplifying. The show is produced by Juraj Toth in Slovakia. Dirk Singer is our Director of Sustainability, who who leads research for each interviewee out of Greenwich, UK. Shubhadeep Pal is our supervising editor based out of Mumbai and Singapore. The articles are written by Ayushi Badola in Dehradun in India and Meera Hull in Montreal, Quebec. Creative design is led by Ligia Esteve in Montreal. Baiba Dreamen is the project director for the show based out of Valencia, Spain. Special thanks to Wendy Sim in Singapore. And I'm Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simplifying and your host. Please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn.